verses, I think, perhaps down as far as verse 10. Then we'll put our verses into context, and then we'll look at verse 4 in particular. So in the Old Testament then, 1 Kings and chapter 19, and we'll read from verse 1 down as far as verse 10. Now, Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done, also how he had executed all the prophets with the sword. Then Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah, saying, "So let the gods do to me, and more also, if I do not make your life as the life of one of them by this time tomorrow." Now, when he received the message, Elijah got up and ran for his life. And he went to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah, and he left his servant there. But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness, and he came and sat down under a broom tree. And there he prayed that he might die. And he said, "It is enough. Now, Lord, take my life, for I am no better than my father's." Then as he lay and slept under the broom tree, an angel suddenly appeared and touched him and said, "Arise and eat." Then he looked, and by his head was a cake baked on coals and a jar of water. So he ate and drank and went back to sleep. Then the angel of the Lord came back a second time and touched him and said, "Arise and eat, because the journey is too great for you." So he arose and ate and drank, and he went in the strength of that food 40 days and 40 nights as far as Horeb, the mountain of God. And there he went into a cave and spent the night there. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him, and he said to him, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And Elijah said, "I have been very zealous for the Lord God of hosts, for the children of Israel have forsaken your covenant, torn down your altars, killed your prophets with the sword. I alone am left, and they seek my life." So let's put this passage then into a context. And to cast your mind back 2 weeks. And 2 weeks ago, we were looking at how this man, Elijah, the only active prophet in Israel at the time, had called for the nation of Israel to gather at the base of a mountain. And that mountain, you remember, is Mount Carmel. And you have the story in chapter 18. And along with Elijah, you have all the prophets of this false god called Baal. Now, the king and his wife were worshippers of Baal. The king and his wife were doing all they could to promote the worship of Baal. And the king and his wife had brought all these prophets from a different country into Israel, and they were persecuting the servants of God. So what we saw 2 weeks ago was this great set piece occasion where there's a great showdown. It's one of the great moments in the Old Testament. It's a moment that you can compare with Moses, when there was a great showdown between Moses and Pharaoh. Two great systems crashing together, the worship of Yahweh and then the gods of Pharaoh. Now, this moment with Elijah is very similar. You have Elijah, the sole representative of God, in a showdown with these prophets of Baal. And do you remember the story? I'm sure you do. I'll just remind you quickly. So it's set on one day, and there are two altars, or if you like, one altar, depends how you read the story. And for the first part of the day, the prophets of Baal appeal to their God that he might send fire from heaven and consume the altar. And we have in chapter 18 a very vivid description of how these prophets of Baal were shouting and dancing and performing their rituals. They were cutting themselves so that they would bleed in an attempt to prove that Baal was able to send fire from heaven. And then you get a pause in the action. And everything stops. And the whole of the audience of Israel fix their eyes on Elijah. What's Elijah going to do? And there he is in total command of the situation. He repairs the altar. He floods it with water. He puts the sacrifice on the altar. And then in one prayer, you have it in chapter 18 and verse 36. In one prayer, he calls to God and the fire comes and the sacrifice is completed. Now, do you remember what we said 2 weeks ago? Well, what Elijah is doing in chapter 18, he's rebuilding the relationship between Israel and God. Led by the king, the nation had turned its back on their God, the God of their fathers, the God of Moses, the God of David. They were turning their backs on this God, and Elijah's first task is to repair the relationship between Israel and God. That's what you have in chapter 18. And what Elijah thinks is that he has managed by his ministry and his prayers, and by the events of this day, he's managed to repair that relationship. And if you take a look at chapter 18 in your Bibles for a second, it does seem as if he succeeded, because the famine that has been going in Israel for 3 years seems to have been brought to an end. Do you remember that dramatic moment when Elijah's looking from the mountain and he sees a cloud rise up and then dart across the sky, and then these dramatic rains fall, and you have the events at the end of chapter 18. So, when you come to chapter 18, it seems as if this relationship between God and Israel has been restored. And then as chapter 19 opens, you get this devastating announcement from the queen. The queen sends a message to Elijah. So this queen now, remember, she's not an Israelite. She is from Sidonia, I think. She comes with her own gods and her own prophets, the ministers, the preachers. And what she has been told by her king, husband, so fills her with anger that she sends a threat to Elijah. So let's read that threat again. It's in verse 2 of chapter 19. So Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah saying, "So let the gods do to me, and more also, if I do not make your life as the life of one of them by this time tomorrow." So what she's doing there is this. Do you remember that when God sent the fire from heaven and burned the offering, Elijah gave a command that all the prophets of Baal should be killed? Now, it's a tremendous sight. It sits very uncomfortable with us today, but there was this mass killing of these false prophets. So what Jezebel does now is a reflection on what happened on Mount Carmel. On Mount Carmel, either Baal or God was going to act. So what she then does in chapter 19 is this. She says, either Baal or God will act again. Either Baal will kill me, or I will kill you. And so she sets up this dramatic tension between what Baal will do to her or what she will do to Elijah. And what you have in verse 3, can you see it? Is Elijah receives the message, and in that moment, what you have in verse 3 is Elijah seems to experience an overwhelming moment of despair, an overwhelming moment of discouragement. So let's stop there for a second and let's imagine ourselves in Elijah's position. Have you ever felt an overwhelming moment of discouragement? Because that's what happens to Elijah. And verse 3 is the key verse, really. We are going to look at verse 4, but the key verse is really verse 3. Because in verse 3, he receives a message. And look at what we are told in verse 3. So he arose and ran for his life and went to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah, and left his servant there. So what you've got with Elijah, and we're not told it in the verse, we are meant to see it in his action. Elijah feels an overwhelming sense of discouragement. And so he gets up, and then he goes as far south as he can in the country. He goes to the very lowest point in the nation of Judah, Beersheba. He leaves his servant, and he goes into the desert. And Elijah, when he goes into the desert, you need to ask a question. Is he going into the desert to die? Or is he going with a fixed purpose? Is there something in his mind and heart that we don't yet know? And we'll see verse 4 in a second, but can I just point out to you something we've mentioned already in prayer meeting about the story of Elijah and Elisha. And we've said that the main theme in these two men is the idea that God provides. God provides and sustains and keeps his people. And what you have here in verses 5 and 6 is a story of God's provision. Think about the widow and her oil. Think about Elijah by the brook. And here you have another example of how God sustains when his people are in the most extreme circumstance. Now, what I would just ask you as well as we sort of pause for a second, this story of Elijah in the desert points forward to Jesus Christ. And I want you to just make a connection between this story in Elijah and what point in the ministry of Jesus does Elijah's experience point to. Now, if you can correctly identify it, you'd also see a difference. There's a big difference between Elijah here and his time and then what will happen in, with Jesus that this story points to. Okay, so let's read verse 4 then, and then we'll ask God to help us as we turn to his word. Verse 4. So he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a broom tree. And there he prayed that he might die and said, "It is enough. Now, Lord, take my life, for I am no better than my father's." Let's ask God to help us then. What's going on then in verse 4? Elijah doesn't want to die. Now, look at verse 4 and you'll tell me I'm wrong. He says, "Now, Lord, take my life, for I am no better than my father's." Well, if Elijah had wanted to die, what would he have done? When he received the message from Jezebel, what do you think he would have done? She is threatening to take his life. She's setting herself up now as a mirror experience to Mount Carmel and what happened there. So if Elijah wanted to die, he would have simply stayed put and allow Jezebel to carry out her threat. So he doesn't want to die. What's going on here is something far more profound, far deeper and more mysterious than any simple wish that his life would end. What we have in Elijah is this. He is a man who has just experienced the direct evidence that God can do wonderful things. That God can send fire from heaven, that God can keep his word, that God can answer prayer. Elijah has just experienced this evidence of the might and the power and the greatness and the majesty of God. And what we see in Elijah is a man who is so buoyed up with the reality of what God can do that he ran as fast as a chariot when he was running with Ahab. This man, one moment, is so encouraged and so motivated and so energized. All his suffering and his sacrifice and his hard work and all the danger that he was in seems now to be worth it because God has revealed his power and answered his prayer. So there's Elijah, one moment, filled with encouragement, and then the next, when Jezebel sends the messenger, Elijah comes crashing down. And I wanted to think about that for a moment or two. You and I are here every Sunday. We are praying. We are seeking to witness. We are seeking to worship. We are seeking to do the right thing. And as you and I meet Sunday after Sunday, it's a little bit like it was for Elijah when he was by the brook Cherith. We come every Sunday, and every Sunday, what do we notice? We notice that the stream is a little bit less. We notice that things have gone down just a little bit more. We are seeing things dry up around us. If we use the idea now of that brook with Elijah next to it, he sat there day after month after year and he saw everything worsen. He saw the situation deteriorate, but he sat there in obedience to God. We are a little bit like that. In obedience to God, we are sitting here and we are seeing things just worsen a little bit every week. And then Elijah has this big moment. A big moment when it looks as if it was all worth it. God has heard our prayers and God answers. And what we have now and again, when we come together on a Sunday, is a moment when everything seems worth it. We have a moment, don't we? And we've had one or two in recent months, when it seems like we're all able to meet together, there's nobody ill at home, and we have a visitor or two, and somebody joins us new, and then there's somebody else who's with us, and it seems just for a moment on one Sunday morning that it's all worth it because God's heard our prayers, and he's listening to us, and he's answered us, and he's brought people in, and there's this one moment when it all seems to be worth it. When it seems as if God has heard us and answered us and responded to us and we are encouraged and our hearts are lifted up and we feel a little bit energized and how good it all is. And then, having had this one moment, one Sunday morning, when it all seems to be getting better, what's the next thing that happens? The next thing that happens is this. It all comes crashing down. And when we meet next, we see just how far things have crashed down. Now, do you recognize this? Because when we look at the story of Elijah and Elisha, We don't look at it as individuals. We look at it as a company of God's people. These two men stand for us as men ministering to the people of God at a great crucial time, a time of famine and challenge, one of the great moments in the history of Israel. And we look at it, we look at the story like that, as a company of God's people. We come and we see that we sacrifice and we struggle and it's hard and it's difficult, but then you get one moment on Mount Carmel and it all seems to have been worth it. And then you get the news, you hear something, something happens, and it seems worse than it was before. My job, looking at verse 4, is to try and get you into the mind of Elijah. And what Elijah is thinking is this. We've had this great victory. God has sent the fire from heaven. We've killed the prophets of Baal. The drought seems to have ended. God has shown his might and his power. God has acted among us. He's shown himself to be God. And why is it that God has now allowed this woman to ruin everything? And in Elijah's mind, you can almost imagine him thinking like this. God can do anything. God can do everything. We don't doubt the might and the power of God. We don't doubt the reach of his arm. We don't doubt the fact that he could change a nation. We don't doubt any of this. So why is it that God doesn't do it? Why would God show us one moment when he can do something great and then that's it? And we get nothing more from him. He leaves us alone and we're back to where we were. Why is it that a God who can do anything and can do everything should choose to do nothing? Why is it? Now let's bring this home. You and I believe that God can do anything. You and I believe that God could save the people we are praying for. You and I believe that God could take us, a handful of people, and he could so work among us that we could grow, that the church could be blessed, that society could be changed. We believe that God could so easily turn the life of this nation around, that God could do mighty works, that God is the God of the impossible. We believe all of this. And we pray for it, and we hope for it, and we encourage ourselves in the thought that God can do anything, and we wait for him. And then we have a little moment when he seems to be doing this work, and then nothing. So here's my question to you. Why is God doing nothing? Why is he allowing things to get worse? Why isn't he doing what he can do? Why not? There's no doubt in the mind of Elijah on Mount Carmel that God will send the fire down, and God sends the fire down. So Elijah then, when he has this messenger from the queen, in an instant, it's as if the room stops, time stands still, and everything crashes down inside his head. Why? Why is God behaving like this? Why doesn't he do what he can so easily do? What does it take? This is what Elijah's thinking. What does it take to get this God to do what he is able to do among us? That's Elijah's moment. And it's a moment that I'm sure all of us, if we take things seriously, it's a moment all of us feel. What will it take to cause God to answer our prayers? What's got to be done so that God will save somebody you're praying for. They're getting older, aren't they? The husbands that you've been praying for, the children, the grandchildren, the great-grandchildren that we have been praying for, they're growing up. They're moving further away. What will it take to cause God to answer our prayers and show what he is able to do? So here's Elijah. And Elijah has a moment in verses 3 and 4 where what he seems to think is, what's the point? And I've had those moments. What's the point? And I'm sure you've had them. We have those moments, perhaps when we come to pray on a Monday. What's the point? We are here every Monday saying the same things, asking this God who can do it to hear our prayers and answer us. What's the point? And we have this overwhelming moment of, what's the point? I have them in the pulpit. Perhaps you have them when you're listening to me in the pews. What's the point? Why are we going on? Why bother? Why come together? Why serve? This is what's happening in Elijah's mind and heart. So take yourselves back to verse 4. And I want you to see what Elijah, what answer does he come up with? Because right in the heart of his statement to God, there is Elijah's understanding of why God isn't answering. Why isn't God working? Why won't God just sort it out and put it right and do what he can do? Why won't he? So take a look at the verse, and do you see what Elijah's understanding is? He says, doesn't he, it is enough. Now, Lord, take my life. So that's a summary is, what's the point? And then you get Elijah's understanding. Do you see it there at the end of verse 4? He says, the reason why God isn't doing anything, I am no better than my fathers. Elijah thinks that the reason why this God who could do anything, why this God isn't doing anything, is because of what he's like. Elijah. It's Elijah's fault. And you and I think, are tempted to think in exactly the same way. Why isn't God working among us? Why isn't he answering our prayers? Why is the little brook going down and down and down and down every Sunday? Why do we get these moments when there's encouragement and then it's all back to what it was? Why is it? And there's our answer. What we think our answer is. It's all our fault. That's what Elijah says. And when Elijah then lays down to sleep, what do you think he expects? He lies down to sleep. Now ask yourself the question. What is he expecting? And it seems to me, and it seems to many, that Elijah doesn't expect to wake up again. He expects to lie down, and he expects that when he lies down and when he sleeps, God will take his life. Just like he's asked God on Mount Carmel, he just prayed once and God acted, here's Elijah doing the same. And so you have in verses 7 and 8, perhaps as far as verse, yes, 6, 7, and 8, you get what many people describe as like a dream sequence. Elijah is sleeping. He's expecting not to wake up again. But as he lies there, there's these angels and this waking up and eating and sleeping and eating and sleeping. There's this sense in which it's all very unreal. Very strange, dreamlike sequence. And then he gets up, finally, and he goes to the Mount of Horeb. Now, we're not going to go any further with the story. I simply want you to think of this from that verse onwards, when he goes to Mount Horeb, and he goes into the cave, and he has this revelation of God, and a still small voice that speaks. We may look at this, we may not. But if Elijah is in that frame of mind, what's the point? God isn't working among us, and it's all my fault. What does God say to him? What does Elijah hear? If you like, what does he need to know? And I'm going to leave that thought with you. I'm not going to answer you. I want you to think it through for yourself. What's this mysterious moment in the cave? What does he need to hear? Now, to give you some help, think back to what we read earlier in the service. We read from 1 Corinthians 15, the final section. We could have read from Galatians 6 and the first 10 verses. Because in those two New Testament passages, you get the answer to Elijah's frame of mind. And what happens in terms of the story is summed up in those two New Testament passages in terms of theology. So a man who thinks, what's the point? This God can do it, but he's obviously not, and it's all my fault. What's the point? Now, what does he need to hear? And what does God tell him?